Today's episode of The Serial Dynasty is sponsored in part by Audible. Audible is offering Serial Dynasty listeners to download one free audiobook. To download your free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/serialdynasty. The majority of the expenses to operate this podcast come from listeners like you through your generous donations. If you'd like to help out in funding this program, simply go to our website, serialdynasty.com, and click the donate button. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Serial Dynasty. In today's episode, we have the wonderful opportunity to sit down with an amazing guest. I was privileged enough to be able to interview one of Adnan's best friends from high school, Krista. You'll remember Krista because of her interviews on Serial. She's also appeared on the Undisclosed podcast a couple of times. And for those of you that have spent a lot of time digging through documents and cell phone records and things of that nature, she's one of the names that you see multiple times appear on Adnan's phone records. They spoke a lot. They spoke on the day of Hayes' disappearance and multiple occasions after that. In a nutshell, Adnan and Krista were very, very close friends. Krista was also very close with Hay. They were all part of the same Magnum program at Woodlawn High School. And as you'll hear in the interview, Krista spent a lot of time with Adnan in the days, weeks, and months following the disappearance of Heyman Lee on January 13th, 1999. I had a fairly lengthy conversation with Krista, so we'll go ahead and get right into the interview. All right, we're here today with Krista. Krista was, as you'll remember from the Serial podcast, one of Adnan's close friends and was featured on Serial as well as Undisclosed. And Krista was gracious enough to let me give her a call today for an interview. So want to say hello to Krista. Hey, Krista, how you doing?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm doing well. I had a busy week, and I'm glad you took the time to sit down and chat with me today. If you don't mind, we can sit down and just talk a little bit about how, you know, things went in high school, your relationship with Adnan and Hay and some of the other players in the, in this whole case, and just kind of walk through kind of what went on back in 1999 and since then. And, before we get into that, I think you'd mentioned, through a couple of emails we had back and forth, did you say that, you come from a firefighting family?
I do. Actually, my dad is a retired firefighter paramedic from Baltimore County. My mom is a firefighter EMT in Baltimore County, and my sister is a FADO EMT with Baltimore County Fire Department.
Oh, wow. So you have a lot of experience dealing with, probably the week that I just had this week.
Yes. And I actually am the president of our local volunteer fire company that I've been a member at since, 2000. So I'm pretty heavy in the fire department activity.
Oh, great. So getting back to all the way back to 1999, Krista, so can you talk to me just a little bit about, your relationship with Adnan? I guess Adnan first, and then maybe, cause you were friends with Hay as well, correct?
Yes, I was friends with both, Hay and Adnan, and I would say pretty much equally. We were a very close-knit group of people, all in the magnet program together. So we kind of had all of our classes together. We did our outside activities together. We all hung out after school, over the weekend. So we spent a lot of time together just as a core group of people. So we all got friendly with one another.
Okay. You know, you just mentioned something about, you guys all hang out after school and things. You know, that's one of the questions that I get a lot and I see thrown around a lot, you know, asking about, Adnan getting a ride from Hay to track practice. Do you recall during that time if that was something that was kind of that happened on a regular basis, that he would catch a ride either from Hay or anyone else down to the track?
To the track specifically, I don't know. But my senior year of high school, I actually left school early. So I decided or chose to only go to school for two periods a day. So I was out of school by 10:45 and then I worked in the afternoons until 5 o'clock usually every day. So I wasn't there to necessarily see whether or not he got a ride to track, but it was not unusual for him to get a ride from her even after they were not dating anymore.
Okay. So that was kind of a common thing.
Yeah, I mean, even if after they broke up, she still referred to him as one of her best friends. They still talked all the time. So it was just that the friendship was still there. The relationship just was not.
Okay, so even was that the case even like after she started dating Don?
Yeah. I know, you know, it was hard, I think, for him a little bit just to know that she had moved on right away. But like I said, they were still very close. So if one needed something non-relationship-wise, like, you know, when Hay's car broke down and she needed help, she would call Adnan even though they weren't together, because they still looked out for each other. They still cared about each other a lot.
So I guess kind of, you know, right to the point before we move on to some of the other things, just to be clear, do you believe that Adnan murdered Hay?
No. I've never in a million years would be comfortable saying that I could wholeheartedly believe that. I had a hard time grasping how some people that we went to school with or some people that we were friends with, you know, 100% were convinced that he was guilty. We did not know anything about the case. We didn't know anything about the case against Adnan, obviously actually until Serial came out this year. So it was kind of eye-opening for me, because for the last 15 years, I've sort of been sitting here like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, this is crazy. I felt like I was the only one that was doubting everything. But now I feel like there's, you know, 5 million people out there that are listening to the same thing with the same thoughts that I have then, that solidifies, all right, something's definitely not right here.
Did the feeling that a lot of that you were getting from a lot of the friends that did believe he was guilty, did some of that start right away after she went missing or after her body was found, or did that kind of come in after Adnan was arrested?
I would say that definitely did not come in until after Adnan was arrested. I mean, we still all hung out together. The night before Adnan was arrested, he left my house at probably 12:01 in the morning. So it's not like he was isolated from the rest of us. He was very much a part of our close-knit group, and never in a million years did any of us imagine that when he left the next day, or, you know, that morning, would be the last time that we saw him outside of prison walls.
And then after he was arrested, I'm sure people assume, I've kind of always assumed that, you know, the police typically get the right guy, and if they arrested him, they had a reason to. And I mean, do you think that played into why people then just assumed, because were there a lot of his friends that, it, you know, after he was arrested, that just really believed that he absolutely did this?
Well, like I said, nobody really knew anything. So we were naive. We were all 17, you know, just turned 18 years old. A lot of people just assumed that if the cops arrested him and he was behind bars, that they had to have had the right guy. They had to have had something on him, but nobody really knew what that something was. Even when it went to trial, all witnesses were not allowed back in the courtroom.
Moving on from, you know, we mentioned some of the other friends that all, you know, once Adnan was arrested, just kind of assumed the police got the right guy. Are you still in contact with any of those old friends from high school?
I still talk to a couple of them. You know, there's people that I keep up with every now and again on Facebook. But there are quite a few, I'd say probably 4 or 5 people from high school that I'm still very close with that we talk on usually like a weekly basis.
Are any of them, that you're still in contact with, any of kind of the, I guess I'd call them the major players in Serial Undisclosed, like Aisha, Becky, Debbie, any of those people anymore?
No, I mean, like I said, not really. I kept up with Aisha, I guess, into college, but, you know, everybody sort of went to college or schools in different cities when we graduated. So once everybody sort of moved away, we didn't really see each other as much as we used to. The only person I think that Sarah interviewed that I'm still in regular contact with is Laura, and her and I talk on a frequent basis.
Okay. Was she one of the ones that kind of was convinced that of Adnan's guilt back in, you know, 99, 2000?
She was, and it's not, I guess, her famous moment, but she was the one, I guess, everybody knows for her talking about how there wasn't a payphone at Best Buy because she knows
she was
the layout
the CDs.
From when she used to, exactly.
So, and from what I remember from listening to her on Serial, she doesn't seem very convinced at this point that he's guilty.
No, and she's never, you know, she's one of the people that I could always sort of talk to about it, because she was never, it never made sense to either one of us, really.
Okay, and Am I remembering correctly that Aisha was somebody that you were pretty close with, that you spoke with after some of the interviews?
Yes. I mean, well, not my interviews with Sarah, but Aisha and I were very close, just, I guess, all through high school. So Hay was Aisha's other best friend, I guess, at the time. So we all kind of hung out. It was usually like Aisha, Hay, Becky, me, our friend Lorna, some of the times our friend Sean. So it was like the same five or six people, and then a few extras that were here every now and again. So that all really hung out and were close together.
Okay. And I think it was mentioned undisclosed that you had spoke with Aisha after she had interviewed with the police. And what do you
remember? The day that
Hay, sorry,
yeah, the day that Hay went, the day that Hay first went missing, you know, Aisha and I used to talk on the phone every night, so it wasn't unusual for her to call me or vice versa. And I believe one of us called each other that night, and she made mention of the fact that she had heard from Hay's family and that they couldn't locate Hay from that evening. And that's when I said, okay, well, you know, I don't know, I'm supposed to get a ride from her or whatever. Has anybody checked in with him? But she's the one that I guess I got most of the information from, you know, when she went missing, when her body was found. I had talked to her that night as well. So she and I kept in close contact on a regular basis back then.
Have you had any contact with her since Serial and Undisclosed have kind of brought all this back to life?
Not necessarily. I did get in touch with her. I know Susan was trying to track her down at one point. So I had kind of just sent her a message saying, hey, you know, would you be interested in talking to anybody regarding Adnan's case?
Okay.
And that was pretty much it. And I don't know if they have connected at this point yet or not, but I at least put that out there that if she's willing to talk about it, that people were willing to talk to her.
Okay. And when you were interviewed, you were only interviewed one time by the police department. Is that right?
The police, yes. I was interviewed the day after Adnan got arrested. So I guess it was a Monday. He got arrested early on a Sunday morning. And Monday we went into school. And I can remember there was like three of us. I think it was myself, Laura, and I think Becky went down to the principal's office. Like first thing that we needed to talk to the police because, you know, they had the wrong guy. There was no way that Adnan was guilty. And unbeknownst to me at that point, the police were already looking to talk to me because of the amount of times that my home phone number showed up on Adnan's cell phone records over that 6 week period.
Okay, they hadn't made any contact with you prior to that when she was missing or the body found, anything?
No, and actually I believe they finally tracked me down by calling my work when I got in there, and they actually came to my place of employment and interviewed me for about an hour and a half. But it was when Billy Garrett came in to my office.
Okay, now in that interview, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, on my podcast and Undisclosed about the methods that the police were using to interview. Do you remember kind of the process in the interview as far as, you know, were they asking you anything about what Hay did, or was it all related to Adnan? And were all the questions leading you in the direction of what Adnan was doing? And kind of leading you to believe of Adnan's guilt already at that point, or how did that process go?
I don't know if they were necessarily leaning towards getting me to try and believe he was guilty, but definitely the line of questioning was all related to him. I can remember specifically, like, up to that point, I didn't have any knowledge that he and I had even talked the night that Hay disappeared. I mean, we talked all the time, we talked on a daily basis, but it didn't dawn on me that that would be why that they were looking for me. And they were specifically honed in on that, you know, 538 call that lasted 2 seconds to find out what was said. And, you know, I'm like, I didn't answer the phone.
Right.
In fact, I can remember, saying, I remember dialing star 69 because I used to get in trouble for having high phone bills and when I was 18, because I would dial star 69 to see who the last caller was. And I actually, like, had a record of my cell phone for that time period that shows on that day at this time that I used that and then called Adnan back, so I didn't actually talk to him when he called at that 5:30, calling me back to hang up on my machine.
And I'm sure with as often as the two of you talked, you probably don't remember that specific conversation.
I do remember some of the conversations from that evening, which, like I said to you before, I don't want to get into too much detail about, you know, what I testified about with that, only because with everything going on, I don't know what's going to end up happening. If he is granted a new trial, obviously there's a possibility that I'm going to have to retestify.
Just in general, during that time frame, do you remember, as far as his tone, do you ever remember getting the feeling from him that something was weird, something was going on, something was up?
Not during the time frame when she was missing. I mean, the only tone that I got after we found out that she was no longer living was more of like sadness. Like, I need her to be here in order to get over her. I don't know how I'm going to get past this. And he was really taking a while to process the fact that she wasn't there. I'm actually the one that called him to tell him that they found her body and that she was no longer alive. And that was just a really raw conversation that I feel like it probably took until he saw the news the next night, and we were sitting there and he literally saw her picture on the 5 o'clock news that her body was found, that's when it clicked and he realized that she wasn't coming back.
And, you know, that's something that's come up a lot, especially recently, a lot of questions about Adnan's, you know, his tone or his reaction during that phone call and then the coming days after learning of her death. I mean, I guess, how would you describe him during that time?
Well, I guess, first of all, I sort of had to pull out of Aisha the night that it was the night her body was found, or the 10th, which I guess was the day after, technically, once her body was identified. When I called her that night, I could just tell something was wrong. And I just kept asking her, like, is everything okay? And finally, I just started with the line of questioning, is, have you heard something about Hay? And she said, yes. And I said, is she still alive? And she said, no. And then I think my next question was, has someone told Adnan yet? And she said, no, can you call him? So of course, I get off the phone with her because I don't know how he's going to react. But I can remember specifically calling him, and he was at home. And I'm like, you know, I just need to make sure, like, you're sitting down. And he's like, what's going on? I said, they found his body. She's not alive. And there was literally, like, dead silence on the other end of the phone. Like, he couldn't even speak. And when he finally could talk, he said, is Aisha home? And I said, yes. And she, you know, he said, I'm going to go over there to her house. And, of course, it was probably 10:30 at night when this happened, and we had school the next day. So I actually called Aisha and I said, Adnan's coming to your house. Do you need me to come over there? And she said, yeah, I don't know that I can deal with him if he's upset on my own. So I actually, you know, I lived in Randalltown at the time, and she lived probably about 15, 20 minutes away from me. And I drove over there to be with both of them. And he was in shock, is the best way that I can say it. He kept saying that, you know, all Korean girls look alike. There's no way they have the right person. It went as far as that he actually picked up the phone and called the police station because he wanted to talk to the detective that had interviewed him a few days prior regarding her disappearance to let them know that there's no way that she was dead. So it was just very much he was numb, if I guess is the best way to describe it. And again, you know, we went through school the next day. We had counselors that were in there, and most of us, honestly, went to school, didn't really hang around and talk to the counselors much, but just kind of left to be with each other because that's what we needed at that point. And, you know, we went over to a friend's house, and he was kind of by himself in the basement, sort of emotional, obviously, for a very good reason. And it didn't really click in my mind to him until we were back at Aisha's watching the news that night. And he kind of broke down and he started crying, and he said that he just needed to call one of the leaders from the mosque who actually came to get him because he just needed to talk to somebody, I guess, to pray or to talk about what he was feeling or what happened. So it was a long process even after that for him to fully grasp things. And I think when he got arrested, he was just starting to accept the fact that she wasn't here anymore and kind of dealing with his grief. But before he was able to do that, you know, he's thrown into this situation where now he's in jail for something that he says that he did not commit. So I feel like he never got to get through the whole healing process, which I'm sure makes it even worse for him.
From the way I understand their relationship, they were you know, they had a romantic relationship, but they were, sounds like they were best friends. I mean, they were
right.
Close before and after, and in the middle of trying to mourn that, then having to deal with, you know, basically fighting for your life through the whole court process, it's just heartbreaking. Now, did you, and I understand, you know, you're not an expert or anything in this, but just from you knowing your friend, did you take, or in your opinion, his reactions during that time, did you see them as being genuine?
Absolutely. There was never a question in my mind that he was being genuine about, you know, the way he was reacting, the way he was feeling, the way he was talking. And, you know, he's a typical teenage guy where he would kind of convey his feelings to some people, but other people, you know, he was a little bit more guarded because he didn't want to be judged for being a guy and being emotional. But I feel like he and I had a pretty open relationship with, you know, discussing our feelings because, you know, we were just close like that. So I don't think that there would have ever been a reason for him to pretend or to not be honest with me about anything. I mean, I literally talked to him all the time.
Yeah, and that was, I guess, one of the biggest reasons that I, you know, that I wanted to talk to you and hear, you know, hear from you in your own voice, because, you know, you don't have to be an expert in psychoanalyzing people. If you know someone and they're your friend, you know when something's not right. You know when something's, I think about like the guys at the firehouse, you know, we're like a family, and I can tell when one of my guys walks through the doors in 10 seconds that something's wrong, something's happened, they're upset, they're mad, there's something. And I feel like you would know more than anyone just by being around him and knowing his personality and who he was, what his reactions meant or what you felt about him. And it sounds like, it sounded like a, you know, a 17-year-old boy that just, you know, lost one of his closest friends.
Exactly. And, you know, I guess for me, it's around that time, I kind of took, I guess you would call it like a motherly role among our friends, in that, you know, I was always checking up on everybody to make sure that they were doing okay, that they didn't need anything, because, you know, it affected a lot of people in different ways. And it kind of made us grow up. Like, we didn't have a choice when we were seniors in high school. It was like, all right, this is real adult stuff that we have to deal with now. And we have to figure out how to live life beyond this. And it's not supposed to happen to kids our age. And it's not supposed to happen when you're in high school. But it did. And we had to figure out a way to deal with our emotions as well as dealing with everyone else at the same time.
It's just amazing that you guys had such a tight group, and that you were all able to be there for you,
right?
That you were all able to be there for each other. You know, as far as all the different friends go that you were had relationships or your friends with in that magnet group, were you close with Stephanie as well?
I was not. She was closer with Laura, who, like I said, I'm still pretty good friends with today. But she, you know, Stephanie was very athletic. She was very into sports. You know, she was very popular. And it's not that we weren't friendly with each other. She's just not somebody that I hung out with outside of school on a regular basis. You know, if we had a big party to go to or, you know, whatever, yeah, she was there, but it wasn't somebody. If we had four or five people and we were all going to the movies, Stephanie usually wasn't one of them.
Okay, and so then in the kind of aftermath of finding out about Hayes passing, she wasn't one of the people that were part of that group when you guys were all kind of meeting and kind of consoling each other?
She was there the night that we found out about Hay not being alive anymore at Aisha's house, actually. As I pulled up, Stephanie did as well at the same time, and that was because I had not called her, and they were pretty close in high school as well.
And you said you didn't know Stephanie real well, so, you know, I guess comparing her reaction to her normal reaction to things would have been a little tougher for you. I mean, she was very close to Hay, correct?
I mean, I wouldn't say that they were really close, but they were friendly with one another again. You know, I don't know that they hung out outside of, you know, after Hay and I broke up. I'm not really sure, I'll be honest with you. Hay was pretty committed at that point in her life to, you know, she worked a lot because she was trying to have her act together to be able to get money, stay focused on college and that sort of thing. So she did work a lot. When she did have time for friends, you know, like I said, she was usually with Aisha. I think, you know, just a few days before she disappeared, Aisha was at my house and she like randomly showed up for dinner, but that was the kind of friendship we had. Like, kind of the door's always open. So if you're in the area, you come by. My mother and father, as well as Aisha's parents, were always really welcoming. We kind of had that hangout houses, if you will, that, you know, if everybody needed a place to go, it was safe to go there. And, you know, our parents would make sure we were taken care of.
So other than that night, did you spend much time with Stephanie, you know, in the next, you know, month or so after that, or, you know,
not outside of school.
Okay. I guess what I'm getting at is I'm just trying to draw out any little bit about Stephanie, because I feel like I just don't know anything about her. You know, like, can you speak at all as far as your impression of her reaction during that time? Was Jay ever around during any of those times when you saw her? Of course, you said you only saw her at school, so probably not. But
I mean, the one thing that I will say, Stephanie was always friendly, always athletic, very popular, very pretty, always nice to everybody. And I think what people tend to forget, you know, they look at it from an entertainment value. And this was a really, really shitty time in our lives. You know, one of our friends got murdered. A lot of people didn't know how to deal with it. Some people stayed introverted. Some people wanted to talk about it. And honestly, for cereal to come up and dredging this up, you know, 15, 16 years later, it's been rough on a lot of people. And, you know, I haven't talked to Stephanie, but I would imagine I have friends that I went to high school with that have, you know, had reoccurring nightmares that started again about Hay's death and Hay's disappearance. And it really kind of screwed with people. So I think people sometimes take it as, oh, Stephanie's got something to hide. I don't think that's it at all. I think that Stephanie is an adult now. She's moved on with her life. Like, this was a really crappy thing that happened. And she's in a different place now, obviously, as all of us are. So she feels like she doesn't have to talk about it. And I can completely respect that, because it was a rough time.
Yeah. And if I remember from hearing some of the interviews, because it, you're right. It is so easy to get lost in all this and forget about the fact that we're talking to, or that we're talking about real people. And I remember, and maybe it was, Lauren on the Serial podcast that mentioned that, that Stephanie, it's not just that when all this came back out, Stephanie's like in hiding. You know, her friends said, a lot of her friends had said that that was her method of coping, that she didn't want to talk about it. She was just kind of shut down about it. And that's, you know, in conversations I've had in emails back and forth with people that are kind of asking about that, it's just that everybody grieves in their own way, you know, and we all kind of think that everyone should grieve the same way we do. And I've seen it, especially in the line of work that I'm in. You know, some people want to talk and they'll talk your ear out. Some people don't want to talk. So, you know, I personally don't think, Stephanie's hiding anything or anything like that. You know, it's, of course, people want to hear from her because she had the connection with Jay, and everybody kind of wants to know very much wants to know what was going on with Jay. But I totally understand the fact that she doesn't want to talk. Like you said, it was a terrible time in your life. And especially with her, you know, her boyfriend being kind of stuck right in the middle of it, right in the middle of her senior year when she's getting ready to graduate and start her adult life, I can only imagine what a horrible experience that was for her.
And as it was with everybody, the last thing that any of us wanted to do, you know, obviously this happened, it's the middle of our senior year of high school, so a lot of us had to come back and take days off from college to testify in the trial. Because, you know, it was kind of like we're trying to move on with our adult lives a little bit and stay focused on school and this new chapter in our lives. But we kept having to revisit the past, I guess, which it was needed for the trial. And in the end, I don't know that it really was effective, because clearly from what we've seen, just the amount of stuff that Rabia and Susan and Colin have uncovered about the lack of information that was shared with Adnan's attorneys. I kind of feel like it was all in vain at this point. Even our testimonies, because had things went a different way, I think it would have had a very different outcome.
Yeah, I can imagine the frustration, you know, when you look at something where, you know, if you could just go back in time and have, you know, have Susan Simpson be Adnan's lawyer, this would be completely different, right? You know? You mentioned testifying, so you did testify in Anand's. Did you testify in both trials or just one of them?
Yes. No, I testified in both trials. The first one started mid to late October. That was the one that ended in this trial, I think. Or it was originally slated to start mid to late October. I think it was a little bit later than that. And then I got called the second child as well. And ironically, some of the testimony or the line of questioning matched, but some of them did not. I think Aisha couldn't come home from school for the first trial, so they might have asked me questions that they ultimately asked her in the second trial. So yes, I testified in both trials. So, you know, it was stressful enough to do it once, but then to find out you had to do it again was even a little bit more surreal.
I'm sure. And especially for somebody who's not used to being on a witness stand, just that process for anything is nerve wracking.
And, you know, I kept in contact with Adnan. I mean, from a week after he got arrested, you know, he still called me. We worked back and forth all the time, continuously for a very long time, and kept in contact even after he was convicted. And the first time I ever saw him after he got arrested was right before I took the stand at the first trial, because they were coming back from lunch. So I was waiting outside to go in, and they brought him around in shackles. And that was just a real, like, I guess a real moment for me, because I knew that he was in jail, but, you know, just to see it like that, it was a little more real.
Before the trial, did you ever have any contact with Kevin Urich? Did the prosecution side ever talk to you, or just Gutierrez?
Gutierrez never spoke with me. I never heard from anybody on NS defense team whatsoever. I did not even talk to Kevin Urich, because I could remember going into the whole process feeling kind of lost, because nobody directed me on, you know, what I needed to do. I did have somebody that went to my church that was an attorney, who is now a judge in Baltimore City. And they knew Kevin Urich, so they were able to kind of, I guess, prep me on, like, what to expect, not necessarily the line of questioning or what it was about specifically, but at least help prepare me for, like, what was going to happen when I got in the courtroom.
Wow. So were you a witness for the defense or for the prosecution?
I feel like that's a trick question.
It's not. I'm not trying to trap you. I was surprised that nobody talked to you beforehand.
The reason that I say that is I was called as a witness for the state. But evidently, you know, in talking to Susan, I think she covered that at some point or in a blog or on the Disclosed podcast, that come to find out I was supposed to be a witness for the defense, but I was never contacted by the defense. And it was a matter of, I believe my address was actually wrong on the subpoenas from the defense, so I never even got them.
Wow, that's a smack my head moment. I can't, like, it's unbelievable to me, because, you know, for you to be, from the little bit of conversation that you had with the police, for the state to call you as their witness just seems odd. And then for them to call you and not talk to you, and I mean, I've testified in a lot of trials, and I've always, you know, had prep from the, you know, not necessarily as far as what to say, but just kind of, you know, what materials you need or what we're going to discuss or things like that. Fact that neither the prosecution or the defense, and especially the fact that, I mean, you would have been a great defense witness. I guess it's not shocking anymore the more I hear about the things Gutierrez was doing, but that she never contacted you at all.
Right. And, you know, Colin brought this to my attention when he sent me, you know, a copy of the subpoenas before. He usually runs some blog stuff by me, which I really appreciate. If it has to do with me first, to see if I have anything to add to it. And, you know, just to kind of see that, and for them to say that they didn't have a way to get in touch with me. And meanwhile, Adnan was writing me letters sometimes 3 or 4 times a week, and would call my house. All they had to do was ask him, and he could have given them my contact information without a problem.
Right. Wow. Sorry, it threw me off a little bit. I wasn't expecting to hear that you were never contacted. It just, and I know I'm repeating myself, but it just blows my mind. I mean, I just had to testify at a trial on Tuesday as an expert witness, and just like every other time, you know, I got a phone call from the prosecutor ahead of time, asking me, you know, what my knowledge was on this particular subject matter. And then in court, prior to going into the courtroom, you know, she talked to me about, you know, what was going to be discussed and make sure I had all my materials that I needed before I went on the stand. I've just never, ever, so I can just imagine, especially, I'm in court all the time. I can only imagine right. for a 17-year-old kid to just walk into court and have to walk up to witness stand and have no idea what's happening. That's just crazy.
Right. And I'm a nervous person as it is. So, like, you know, I'll say, or like, or, you know, whatever a lot when I'm talking. And that's what I was focused on, was just trying to, like, answer the questions and not, you know, get nervous and start shaking or anything like that. Just because you literally, it's very intimidating. You're on the stand. There's a judge next to you. And I can remember the judge from the second trial was just very stern. She wasn't nice about anything that she said. If you weren't talking loud enough, she kind of would get crappy with you. And you just don't know how to take that. Like, am I in trouble?
Right. Yeah.
What's going on here? I thought I was here to, like, answer questions, and I'm getting yelled at, and I don't understand why.
I think I've had that judge before. There's a particular judge that's in one of the local courts here that every single time I testify, she yells at every single witness for not being loud enough for the recording to get it. Yeah, and so there'll be these poor people come in to testify, and she's screaming at them because they're not loud enough. I can just
right.
imagine.
Like, they're not intimidated enough already, and you're making it worse.
Yeah, it's just nerve-wracking. Were the witnesses sequestered, where you had to be out of the courtroom through the rest of the trial? You could only be in there during your part?
Yes.
Okay, so you didn't get to see a lot of Gutierrez and Urich work.
No. We weren't allowed in there literally at all. And we were lucky. I think most of us were lucky that they had nailed down. You never know, obviously, how long it's going to take to question the person before you. And I can just remember, you know, sitting in there, and I'm like, oh my God, it's 2:00. Like, am I going to get in today, or am I going to have to come back and do this again tomorrow? Because, of course, you know, with a courthouse, there's only so many empty rooms that you sit in and be bored to tears all day. They're just waiting for your turn to get on the stand.
Anything else that you want to hit on?
I mean, not necessarily. I've had a lot of people ask me, you know, about the serial experience. It's been very surreal, obviously. And like I said, it's one of those things where I feel like all these people out there now know how I felt 15 years ago when this all happened, when I was going, if something's not right here. So it kind of solidified my feelings, because back then all of our friends sort of, you know, went in different directions, and nobody ever really talked about it after it happened. So you didn't know what so-and-so said, or, you know, what was testified to. So there's been just so many holes for the last 15 years to know what was said that made a jury so convinced that he was guilty. And now, looking back, you know, I guess I can understand what they heard, but the way that it was presented or the amount of information was missing, you know, makes me feel a little bit better about why I questioned it for as long as I did, and why I could never, you know, grasp the fact that the people would believe that Adnan did it. And I, when all this started, because Sarah actually reached out to me last February, so February 2014, you know, and she tracked me down at work and left me a voicemail. I was actually working from home in the snow, and I get this voicemail from this reporter wanting to know about my friend Adnan Syed, and I'm like, this is 15 years ago. What is this lady want? So I was a little nervous to meet with her because I had no idea what it was about. And I think the interviews that I had with her ended up being more me asking her questions and her, you know, clarifying for me what she had come across already. And I was able to give her a little bit of insight, you know, beyond just the Muslim community or what the police report said. It was more like at the social level of school and, you know, what we dealt with within the community of Woodlawn High School versus, you know, the Muslim community, or, you know, the Woodlawn, you know, Catonsville community where he actually lives. So I think that helped give her some depth. But I've gotten really involved with, you know, there's a Facebook discussion group about Adnan's case, which had burned exponentially. I think it had 5,000 people in it at one point, which now I think we've cut it down to 2,000 that are, like, really interested in talking about the case. But it helped me a little bit sort through things, because I'm able to talk about it with other people that might have access to more information regarding the case or the court system. You know, talking to Susan, talking to Colin, you know, and talking to Sarah, obviously, it's helped me get a better understanding on all the questions that I've had over the last 15 years.
Yeah, I can only imagine when you got that call. What I guess for most people, the first question would have been is, what's a podcast? Were you aware of even what that was then? Because I hear that a lot.
Well, I mean, at first, I think it didn't even start that Sarah was even doing it as a podcast. Like, it wasn't even a thing called Serial at that point. It was that she was a journalist for This American Life, and she was doing a story. And then it kind of evolved into this podcast. And I just remember getting a email from her the beginning of October saying, hey, here's the link to the first episode of Serial. This is what's going to be released every week. You know, as promised, I'll keep in touch with you guys. And Sarah was really good at fact-checking. Like, if an episode was due to come out on Thursday, some days she was still emailing me on Monday just to make sure that the information that she had was correct, or if she had a blank that she needed filled in. But it kind of evolved to something that I think that Sarah had no idea, you know, how big it was going to get or how many people were going to listen to it. You know, she probably thought maybe a couple of hundred people, not thinking millions of people were going to get involved with the case.
I'm sure, and I'm sure you probably thought the same thing.
Yeah, and I've dabbled and read it a little bit. I was on what they refer to as the dark sub for a little while, and I ran into some people that just weren't very, very nice. They weren't very understanding of, you know, I was in the situation, and my answers might not lead to you thinking that he's guilty, or you are not going to be able to convince me that he's guilty, because you're sitting behind a computer screen, reevaluating things that you think are facts, but I'm looking at it as, he's a friend of mine who I know very well. And to me, there's some things that I would never be able to accept, and his guilt would be one of them.
Yeah.
I've worked, you know, obviously when you put something up on Reddit today, and one of the more private ones or whatever, I'm so active in those. If people have questions, you know, I don't go on there often, but I'll check and see if I have any messages now and again. But I try and be good about responding to people if they do have questions that I can answer that won't put any sort of future testimony in jeopardy.
Yeah, it's kind of a unique situation you're in, with everything kind of in limbo right now. And I've had some of those same experiences with, you know, and Reddit can be, you know, I found that it can be a great tool, because there's a lot of intelligent people on there with a lot of good things to say. But it's like, my goodness, you have to filter through 300 comments, and, you know, 200 of them are people that are, like you said, they're just not very nice, and they're just arguing with each other. So it's tough to filter through all of that. So I remember another question that I wanted to ask you. Since Adnan has went to prison, have you seen him or spoken with him since he's been in actual prison?
Yeah, he and I kept in actually, ironically, regular contact. He and I spoke all the time, probably till about 2005. And that was the point in time where I actually got rid of my landline and only had a cell phone. And at that point, it was collect calls, and you couldn't do collect calls to cell phones. So he and I kind of stopped communicating by phone then. And I went to visit him in jail, at Jessup. I don't even know how many times, probably somewhere between 5 and 10. And, you know, my sister, Katie, would go with me, or my best friend Alexis would go with me. And, you know, he just added into visiting list so that I wouldn't be bored on the drive up there or whatever. And, you know, they both knew him. So I have gone to prison to see him post-conviction. And to me, he's still out now. He's not any different than the day before he was arrested, except, you know, if I hug him more than once, then I get yelled at by the guard in jail. that's pretty much it. There was a mix-up at the jail at some point, where they did an audit of the visiting list for all the prisoners, and a lot of people got removed because they were identified as people that could potentially have relatives that worked in the prison system, which I do not, but I got flagged and got removed from his visiting list. And that never got worked out. And by the time, I think it even probably could have gotten worked out, he got transferred, to where he is now.
And so you haven't seen him since he's been at the prison he's at now?
Correct. Probably 05 or 06 was probably the last time I saw him. He and I corresponded still through letters, you know, not as frequently as we did, immediately, but we did write back and forth a lot, probably until 2010, 2011. I had some stuff going on in my life where I just got super busy. And then once I interviewed with Sarah, he and I started corresponding again. So I still do write him. I send him pictures of my son, stuff like that, just to try and keep in contact with him and help him to realize there are people on the outside that still very much care about him too. And honestly, you know, my biggest hope besides just him, you know, getting out, ideally in the perfect world, where I'd love for him to get out, you know, regardless, because I truly believe that he's innocent. For me, if they could find out who really killed Hay, that would almost be the silver lining, because it would be able to put this entire thing to rest. And not that I don't want to see him get out on a technicality, but I feel like the ultimate win would be if somewhere in all this, either someone could come forward and admit their guilt, or the DNA test brought forward, you know, who else was in her car that maybe had no business being there, that could release some more information about who could have possibly done this to her. And that's what my ultimate hope is. I know it's a long shot, but I, you know, I keep my fingers crossed every day that that's going to happen.
You know, me too. And I'm sure maybe I'm overly optimistic about it, but you know, the reason I keep driving forward with this podcast, you know, it's evolved a long ways since, you know, we started it, you know, over 2.5 months ago, from just kind of a place to get our ideas out to really being on a mission to find the killer. And I just, for some reason, I just feel in my gut that we're going to get there, that we're going, you know, there's someone out there that knows what happened, and there's just got to be a way to reach them. And then of course there's the DNA evidence and all of that out there. I'm with you. I hope and pray and I truly believe that we're going to find out who did this.
And I think what resonated with me most out of the whole serial, the whole 12 episodes, was in the last podcast when Sarah's talking to Adnan about his case, and you just hear the emotion in his voice, which to me, it sounded like he was on the verge of tears when talking about the DNA evidence, that he has nothing to be afraid of, that he wants them to test everything that he possibly, you know, they possibly could. And had he known about this 15 years ago, I think things could have been completely different than they are right now.
It would be a different world, I think, right now for a lot of people if things had been done differently in 15 years ago.
Absolutely.
Well, Krista, I really, really appreciate you calling in, and it's been really cool to talk to you. And anytime you need anything or you have something you want to talk about, please feel free to get in touch with me again. I'm sure I know myself, and I'm sure all of my listeners would love to hear from you another time, somewhere as we continue on with this and move on down the road.
Absolutely. And, you know, my Facebook is private, but my Twitter is definitely not. So if anybody sends me a message or has a question, if it's something that I'm comfortable asking or answering, I definitely will. You know, people have asked me questions that I'm not comfortable answering, and I will be 100% upfront and honest that I'm not okay with that, or I have no idea, because I don't like speculating about other people. I don't like speculating about what could have happened. But, you know, I have had some people email me with some off the wall theories that, you know, I can just say, no, that definitely didn't happen.
Yeah, you should see my email box.
Right, I'm sure yours is quite interesting.
Yeah. Do you want to give out your Twitter handle?
So I've had the same Twitter handle since I bought my first brand new car, which was a Jeep Wrangler. So my Twitter handle is Jeep, the letter R, the number 4, and CHCKS, so Jeeps are for chicks.
Nice. I like it. All right. Well, if anybody wants to get a hold of Krista or ask her any questions, you can always tweet her at that handle, which is at JeepsR4Chicks. Did I get that right?
Yeah. It just doesn't have the I in chicks, but yeah.
Okay. Sounds good. And thank you very much, Krista, for calling in again. And I really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll be in contact again going down the road.
All right. Well, thanks for contacting me.
All right. Take care, Krista. Thank you.
All right. Have a good night.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
All right, I hope all of you enjoyed that interview with Krista. Given that there was not a lot of new information brought out in the last couple of weeks, since myself as well as the Undisclosed team took a bit of a hiatus for the holiday, I thought it'd be nice to hear from another one of Adnan's friends. And also, I think Krista is just a great source to help us kind of get an idea of what Adnan was like, what his reactions were, what his responses were, really get a good understanding of how Adnan was acting, reacting, responding to the different revelations in the case as Hay went missing and her body was found, as well as after his arrest. You know, we're looking at pieces of evidence and we're looking at documents from 15 years ago, but it's sometimes we have to wrap our brain around the practicality of, you know, the people that knew him, the people that were close to him, how he was acting during the months following the disappearance and death of Heyman Lee. Now, before I close the show today, I'd like to read a couple of listener emails. The two emails that I have today both relate to the same basic question. So I'm going to go ahead and read both emails and then I'll respond. Hi, Bob. You're doing great work with the podcast. I know you've addressed this issue at various points, but I wanted to get your full opinion on the matter. What has led you to believe that Jay was involved in Hay's death? During Serial, I don't think I was alone in considering the virtual lock that Jay had something to do with it, given that he had led the police to the car, seemed to know details about the body, was possibly in possession of Adnan's cell phone that pinged the Lincoln Park Tower around the alleged 7 p.m. burial time, and of course implicated himself in his own story. But with what we've learned since Serial, aren't all these things we thought we knew almost certainly false? Whether Jay actually led police to the car seems a questionable at best proposition. And if he did, he admitted at trial that he saw the car before he talked to the police as part of his normal routine. The most striking detail Jay relayed about Hay's body, that it was, quote, pretzeled up in the trunk, is almost certainly false due to the lividity report. The infamous Lincoln Park pings from the cell tower evidence, never a conclusive or exact science to begin with, are now basically irrelevant thanks to that same lividity report and Jay's news story in the Intercept interview. And the fact that Jay implicated himself now seems less far-fetched given that the police had picked him up on a charge shortly before the whole thing, which seemingly due to his cooperation with the police was delayed and eventually dropped, and that the police were threatening to charge him with Hay's murder if he didn't cooperate. Jay himself confirms this arrangement at trial. The trial clip is played during Undisclosed Episode 3. So what is it that has you thinking Jay was involved, and that the detectives didn't invent the story out of whole cloth, and threatened to press the case against Jay if he didn't verify it? This seems to be exactly what they were accused of doing in at least one other case that was discussed on Undisclosed. Given the ghastly cultural report that was provided early in the investigation, how likely is it that they chose Adnan as the suspect because they viewed him as an easy target to prosecute, and Jay is the witness because he was an easy target to intimidate? Thanks for your time, Kyle T. And Kyle gives his Twitter handle, @KyleLovesTV. Thank you, Kyle, for that email, and it's an excellent question, and I'll get to the answer to it in just a moment. But I want to first read my next email, because part of how I'm feeling on the topic is addressed in this next email as well. So my next email is from Brianne. Brianne says, "Hello, Bob. First, I just want to say I love your show. It is amazing to see how many people out there care about justice for Hay Lee and for Adnan. At this point, I have gone from theory to theory, and just when I think I have a viable theory, I remember some detail that makes me realize the theory is about as plausible as Jay's story. But I do have some things I wanted to throw out there and see if you or anyone else has been thinking about these same issues. I was convinced for a while that Jay completely fabricated his involvement with this case, that he knew someone that was actually involved in the crime, for example, Davis, Moore, or a mystery person, and got enough details to insert him into the story and make himself seem important and cool to his friends. On Serial, there were many interviews in which people close to him admit that he is a liar, a teller of tall tales, and that no one believed anything he said. So just when I think Jay really has nothing to do with this, except that he has only heard something about it and brought Adnan into it to get out of his legal troubles, I remember one thing. Jen. How do you explain Jen? She would have no reason to go along with Jay's complete fabrication or implicate herself in covering up for the crime. This leads me to think Jen and or Jay must have been involved in the actual crime. They are also completely adamant about giving each other an alibi on the 13th from approximately 3:30 to 4 p.m. time frame, even though this is completely contrary to the state's case presented at trial. Why is that? I think this time window must be the critical time of the crime, and they have to put themselves together at that time to avoid anyone uncovering where both of them actually were. We know there is an inconsistency. Their story is already when Jay claims to be at Jen's house at 3:21 p.m., yet is calling Jen's house from a non-cell phone. That leads me to believe that Jay was really not at Jen's house at that time. So where was he? Where was Jen? Is she just covering for him? So as you can see, I go from Jay is completely innocent to Jay is involved firsthand in a matter of minutes. I'm sure you can relate to this type of thinking. Thanks for taking the time to read, Brianne. Well, thank you, Brianne, for sending that email in, and I certainly can relate to that type of back-and-forth thinking. The truth is, I don't know. I have my speculations and theories, but I really don't know. But to answer both of your questions, yes, I personally do believe that Jay and Jen were involved in this crime. Now, understand that just because I'm the one behind the microphone doesn't make that necessarily correct. That's just my take on it. And I have several reasons for thinking that way. First and foremost, I have the same reservations about Jen that Brianne does. If this was just Jay, I think I could buy into the idea that Jay actually had nothing to do with this crime. But Jen is just this nagging detail that I can't get out of my head, and I can't figure out how to do anything with it other than to believe that she does know something, she was involved, or that Jay was involved, and she's trying to protect Jay. Or that Jay's telling the truth, and she's just confirming Jay's story. But the fact that Jen gets brought in first. Now again, we all have to remember that we don't even know that for sure. We seem to have pretty solid evidence that the police were speaking with Jay prior to the night he was brought in for questioning before they arrested Anon. But before him, they bring Jen in. She claims she doesn't know anything. And remember, at that time, depending on what you want to believe, they're looking for Anon at that point. They may or may not know that Jay has any involvement at all. My personal theory, and it's just that a theory, is that they didn't know that Jay was involved yet at that point. If they had done the tower dump, as mentioned in Undisclosed, they had pulled the cell phone records, all they would see is Adnan's phone making all these calls to Jen. So they bring Jen in, and Jen says she doesn't know anything, and she leaves. Now, granted, when she left, the police told her, no one's a suspect, and everyone's a suspect. So there was certainly some fear put into her when she left that interview. So what I feel happened, and it's just that, a feeling, the feeling in my gut, it scared the hell out of her. And the only reason that it would scare the hell out of her is if she knew something. Either she knew something, or she was directly involved or indirectly involved in the crime. If she literally had no idea what happened, because none of this is true and it's completely made up, I don't see why in the world she would come back to the police station. She was asked about a crime that she knew nothing about. She knew she knew nothing about it. She knew she wasn't involved in it. Why come back? So then she comes back and she brings a lawyer. Now, I've had a lot of emails and tweets and comments about the fact that they think that Jen bringing a lawyer implicates her in some guilt in some way. And I don't believe that. I think that anyone in her situation, if they had the ability to do so, would certainly bring a lawyer with them. But what just keeps sticking with me is I could see someone who had nothing to do with this crime and knew nothing about this crime coming back the next day with their mother and a lawyer back into the police station, but for a different reason than why Jen came back. I could certainly see a teenager and her mother, an attorney, marching into a police station and letting them know in a not-so-nice way that they will not be harassing and intimidating this young girl. But that's not what Jen did. She went back to the police station to tell a story. She went back with her attorney and her mother and spilled the beans about Jay having a non-cell phone, about the fact that Adnan committed the crime, and Jay helped. And remember, she didn't say she saw any of this. All she said is that that's what Jay told her. So I still wrestle with the idea that it's possible that Jen believes Adnan did it, and she believes that Jay helped out with it, but really had no involvement in the crime at all, and is simply basing those thoughts and that testimony on what Jay told her. And as we know and we've heard time and time again, Jay lies. So I don't think that's something that we can just throw out. It's a viable theory in my mind that she went in there thinking she was telling the truth because that's what Jay told her. But as we consider her statement further, remember that she implicated herself in helping to destroy and hide the evidence and conceal this crime, which is a huge crime in and of itself. So if we're led to believe that Jen's sole intention was to go into the police station and snitch on Adnan and or Jay, why implicate yourself if you had no involvement? There's no purpose there. Or at least I can't see a purpose there. And maybe someone more intelligent than me can see it, but I just don't see it. If we're to believe that Jen literally had nothing to do with this crime, knew nothing about it, the police had nothing hanging over her head, and she went in to fabricate some story or to retell a story that was created out of cloth from the police, why implicate herself? I just can't bring myself to believe that she would do that. It would have been easy enough to say, okay, it was Jay calling me that day. Jay had Adnan's cell phone. And later on, Jay told me that Adnan killed Hay. Go talk to Jay and walk out of there. But in a way, she threw, well, not in a way exactly, she threw all three of them under the bus. And then considering the fact that Jen had an attorney with her gives me even more pause. Not that I think she's guilty because she had an attorney, but she went into the police station with her mother and an attorney. Unlike Jay. She had protection. She had someone there letting her know what her rights were. She had someone there making sure that she wasn't bullied or coerced. If she had nothing to do with this, I don't believe there's an attorney out there that would advise her to completely lie and fabricate the story, implicating herself in a felony. So that's my basic reasoning for why I believe Jen is involved in at least some way. Now, that could mean a couple of things. It could mean that she was involved with Jay in the murder and Adnan had nothing to do with it, and they decided to pin it on Adnan to save their own skin. Or it could mean that the murder really happened the way that Jay said it did, right? I mean, she could be telling the truth, or at least a version of the truth she heard from Jay. Now, you can choose to believe whichever one of those options that you want, but either way leads me to the conclusion that Jen was most certainly involved in the crime. And again, that's just my opinion, and I'm the one with the microphone. But that doesn't make my opinion hold any more weight than any of yours, so I'd love to hear your thoughts and responses to that over the next week. So then moving on to Jay's involvement, I believe it's possible for witnesses to be coerced. And there certainly seems to be some of that in Jay's case. When he's in there alone with no attorney and the police are telling him, if you don't tell us what we want to hear, we're going to charge you with the murder. But again, I go back to the fact that Jen implicated him. His best friend, Jen, implicated him in this crime. So I don't believe the versions of the story that Jay told. And if I did, I couldn't choose which one of the versions to believe. And we know that most, if not all of them, are not even possible given the actual physical evidence. But Jay was involved, in my opinion. Yes, the police had something to hold over him. But it was a misdemeanor offense. Now, is that enough for you to implicate your friend in a murder that you were involved in? Could be. Is that enough to completely fabricate and make up a story about a murder where you assisted in the murder and helped to cover it up? I just don't think it's enough motivation for all that. I believe that if Jay literally knew nothing about this and as the story was created out of cloth, I think he just walks out of there. Now, that being said, everyone's different, everyone has different motivations, everyone has a different moral compass. But like all things, what we have to do is look at a preponderance of the evidence, or at least that's my method. And when I consider those facts, along with the facts that I mentioned about Jen earlier, and you put those all together, I'm not saying it's not possible that the two of them had nothing to do with it. I'm just saying I don't personally think that that's the most likely scenario. Now, I get lots and lots of emails from listeners asking about the corruption of the Baltimore Police Department. And if I think this was this massive conspiracy where they framed the Muslim and put him in prison, and wondering what I think about that. I've swung pretty wildly back and forth between tinfoil hat conspiracy theory to maybe this is all in our heads, to kind of where I've landed now. And my theory on what was going on with the police is based on a couple of things. I've done some research. I've been in contact through email with a Baltimore City police officer who wants to remain anonymous and does not want to come on the show. But he's been able to shed a little bit of light, as far as generalities are concerned, about how detective work works in the Baltimore Police Department. and he had given me a lot of the same information that I got from Michael Wood in my email interview with him, that everything is about closing the case. It's not a massive grand conspiracy. They don't have it out for any of these people. It's just a matter of closing the case and moving on to the next one. Which that was really hard for me to wrap my brain around, given the fact that I'm from a very small town. And that's not an issue here. We're not dealing with hundreds of murders a year here. Every big case is just that here. It's a big case. Most of the local officers I speak to here are looking through those lenses, saying, I would never do that. Of course I wouldn't. Everything's by the book. But when you deal with 2, 3, or 4 murders in a year, of course that's the case. When you're dealing with 300, it's quite a different situation. And shamefully, I must admit that I've gotten a lot of information and insight into the Baltimore Police Department, in part by the TV show The Wire. Several listeners recommended that I watch that show, and I was reluctant to do so just because it may show how a police department in Baltimore works, but it's fiction, it's TV. However, after discussing it with this Baltimore City cop, from what he's saying, it's pretty accurate. That's pretty close to the way things work. And then after the email interview with Michael Wood, and I kind of compared what he had responded to my questions to the show The Wire, and I see the same similarities. They're closing cases. They're cutting corners. They're doing whatever they have to do to close cases. So based on that information, a couple of conversations with Baltimore City cops, and watching a TV detective show, which I'm sure all you are realizing right now makes me the expert, giving that information, what I think happened was just, I don't think there was a grand conspiracy. I think that this was one more murder added to a huge caseload for Ritz and McGillivray. There's pressure from all these murders to get them closed, to get those clearance rates up, to get the cases shut down and move to the next one. I think that this case had a little more pressure than most cases, given the fact that Jada Lambert was murdered just 9 months prior, another 18-year-old Woodlawn student strangled, dumped in a park. I think that the brass and the DA were breathing down the throats of these detectives to get this thing closed. I don't think that they looked through the yearbook and picked out a Muslim and went after them because they wanted to charge a Muslim. I don't think that's what happened at all. I think that they were looking for leads and they had none. Now, typical suspects in this type of case, of course, are going to be the boyfriend, ex-boyfriend. They quickly looked into both and they didn't find anything, which coincidentally is part of the reasons I believe so strongly in Anand's innocence at this point, is through their initial investigation, they weren't finding anything that was giving them any reason to bring Anand in. They weren't finding evidence. The initial interviews that they did not implicate Anand. But somewhere along the lines, someone said, you should check out Anand. Now, whether that's the anonymous phone call or whether that's Heyman Lee's family, from what I understand, the cultural consultant was actually contacted by Hay's family, so it's possible Hay's family thought Anand maybe had something to do with it. I don't know. But I think what happened was they were grasping at straws to try to find a suspect, to charge somebody with this murder. I personally believe that Ritz and McGillivray believed that Anand was guilty, or they wanted to believe that he was guilty. I don't believe that it was a, quote, frame job on Anand. And I know we're splitting hairs here, and it's a subtle difference between the two, but I think at some point they were at least suspicious. They believed he's suspect number one. They think he's a good suspect. And so they started honing in on him. They were looking for evidence. They were cutting corners. They were trying to find anything that they could use to give him a charge. But you'll notice he wasn't brought in. It's almost 3 weeks after Hay's body was found before they finally brought him in. He wasn't put into an interrogation room, nothing like that. I believe they really had nothing until they decided to contact Jen based on the cell phone records they had pulled. And they absolutely pulled those cell phone records because they already had their mind made up and Anand did it, even though they didn't have any evidence. And all of a sudden, Jen gives them Anand on a silver platter. And I think in the detective's mind, Jay is peripheral to this. See, they've already been working on building a case for Anand. They're one step closer to closing this one, to filing a charge. So Jen says it wasn't Anand calling me, it was Jay. But Jay's saying that Anand's the one that actually killed her. Bingo. They'd already been working on building a case against Anand. Jay comes in. He starts to try to lie his way out of it, as he always does. And when he realizes that it's very possible that he's going to get charged with this, he points the finger at Adnan. Now, you can believe that he snitched on Adnan or that Adnan was a patsy. But in this discussion, we're wondering what was going on with the police. And I really believe that that's how it went down. When Jay flipped on Adnan, of course the police were going to run with it. And they're going to keep building their case. And they're going to keep Jay in that room. And they're going to offer him whatever they have to offer him to help them manipulate this timeline to close this case. Now, do I think somewhere along the lines, Ritz and McGillivray realize that it's very possible Adnan didn't do this? Yes. And that's where the corruption comes in my mind. And that's the part that makes me sick. There are millions of us out there home sleuthing this case. We're not detectives. We're not police officers. We're not prosecutors. But we can see that this story doesn't add up. I don't believe that Ritz and McGillivray didn't see that. I think they didn't care if they had their guy. They had a guy. And they had their star witness that was giving them their case on a silver platter. And this is where I think the Muslim angle played very heavily into this. And it certainly did earlier as well, as we've heard in the Undisclosed podcast, that the police were only subpoenaing cell phone records for other Pakistanis or Muslims. But I think they had a witness that was willing to play ball. They had this cultural memo that provided them with a motive. Adnan's attorney was not even attempting to find an alibi for him. They could close it and move on. So that's my opinion on what was going on with the police department and with Ritz and McGillivray specifically. And it makes me sick. It's a way of thinking that I just can't understand. I know so many police officers, and the ones that I know, they're just good people. They're good cops. I understand that they're in a different culture in Baltimore than they are here in small town Michigan. But damn it, these are people's lives. Thank you all so much for tuning in today, and thank you again for all of the support you've continued to provide through sending in all of your emails, tweets, Facebook messages. You listeners are the driving force behind this show. I want to thank you for all of your help in assisting with the funding of this program. And again, if you'd like to help out with the funding, you can always go to audibletrial.com/serialdynasty and download a free audiobook, or you can donate directly to the program through our website, serialdynasty.com, and click the donate button. Thanks to all of you, our audience is continuing to grow. Please help keep that momentum rolling by continuing to tell your friends about the show, talk about the Serial Dynasty on social media, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. If you haven't done so already, please take a moment to go onto iTunes and review the show. And keep sending in those theories and thoughts to theories@serialdynasty.com. And as always, you can always get a hold of me on Twitter @serialdynasty. Special thanks to Johnny Rose of Slightly Subversive Music, who created the music for the show, and also to listener Tate, who created our new logo. Don't forget tomorrow night to download the new Undisclosed episode number 7. I want to thank you one more time for listening and contributing, and until next week, this has been the Serial Dynasty.